Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Philip McHugh from FlexCharge. FlexCharge is innovative, new payments and fintech technology for e-commerce merchants that allows them to recover up to 30% of their orders lost to payments declinatures. It's amazing technology that allows merchants to keep more of the orders that they have worked so hard to earn. I hope you enjoy our interview. This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Philip McHugh from FlexCharge to the pod. Welcome, Philip.
Hey, Jason. Great to see you. Looking forward to it.
It is great to see you again. This is the first time in the history of the podcast in 325 plus episodes that I've actually had to re-record an entire episode from scratch due to technical difficulties the first time around. So I really appreciate you persevering with me, Philip.
No, I enjoyed the first time around, so it'll be even better the second time. So it's all good.
Well, we've had a dress rehearsal, so this one should be absolutely amazing.
Definitely.
Listen, I did enjoy that first conversation, and the platform that you and your team are building is what I would call, I hesitate to use the word groundbreaking because I think sometimes it's overused, but I think in your case, it's very apt. And I also think that some of the things that you guys are doing, I haven't seen done by anybody else anywhere in the world. I know fintech gets a bad rap sometimes, and especially with the implosion of FTX and some of the other things, the shenanigans with buy now, pay later and bad debts and all those sorts of things. I think fintech sometimes unfairly gets a bad rap, and any kind of fintech gets tarred with the same brush, so to speak. And what I think you guys are doing is actually amazing for merchants. But before we get into that and we dig in into what FlexCharge actually is and does for merchants, how the heck did you get into the fintech space to begin with? Because it was a little bit of a circuitous path.
Yeah, no, the fintech, I think I spoke about this last time. I'm a 20-year banker. In the last 10 years, I reinvented myself as a cool fintech dude. But the fact is, I started in Citigroup in Latin America, and I started my career in payments. I was in credit cards down there, and this is all brand new. This is mid-90s. So you really learned the space there. The first co-brands created in Latin America with the team I was down there with. I went to Barclays in big financial roles, but I ended up at Barclaycard. And Barclaycard is payments. It's fintech. It's hidden in a bank. But it was the number two payments platform in all of Europe. There's Worldpay and Barclaycard are the big two. We had a huge commercial business and did B2B solutions. We had a big BNPL. And so you really came back and got very involved in that. And then eventually I left banking, but stayed in payments. And at both TSYS, where we really drove one of the larger merchant acquiring businesses in the country, I did a lot of mergers with businesses, very focused on retail and then focused in health. So like really solving great payment solutions. And then I went to Paysafe, which was an incredibly innovative gaming and gambling leader. So digital wallets and e-cash and e-commerce gateways and demanding, that's extremely demanding retail use case. You've got very spiky demands in payments. You've got to do payouts. The risks are hard to manage. And so the companies that can keep pace with those types of merchants and those types of demands are pretty sophisticated. And then after I left and we IPO'd that business, I spent time just really advising tons of different companies. And I came across FlexCharge and I had the same reaction you had, which is this feels different. The DNA of the people that have created the founders, Elio and Zev, are different. They come from Experian and they have this incredible credit data background and real-time decisioning and analytical rigor that just does not exist with your traditional fintech payment teams. And most importantly, they're solving a real problem that merchants have. And frankly, from my side, payment service providers that they have and that kind of nexus of their DNA, the problem they're solving, how pertinent it was to both the payment provider and to the merchant, just hooked me in, and I've got sucked into helping start a new business, and it's been a blast.
Sounds like a heck of a lot of fun. Now, what I love about this, and let's just define the problem that you guys solve for, and let's put it into terms that almost anybody can understand. First of all, merchants, they probably have more declines of purchases through their websites than what they even realize. So let's say you're running Stripe today as your primary payment gateway, as many do, but it could be any payment gateway. Most of these payment gateways have their own anti-fraud systems built in. If we look at Stripe, Radar is their anti-fraud system. There are also third-party anti-fraud systems that can sit in front of payment gateways to effectively front-run that information to say, look, should we even send it to the payment gateway to see if we want to process this transaction? Is it too high risk? And then there is post-purchase gateway functionality, which is the likes of your Signifieds and some of the other platforms that effectively guarantee payments, and they effectively provide insurance to make sure that you will get paid, even if the transaction ultimately ends up to be fraudulent. So we've got, as of today, we've got three major areas where anti-fraud technology comes into play. It's pre-gateway, it's in the gateway, and it's post-gateway. And that's really how the market operates. But what happens in most cases is that merchants do not understand what percentage of total attempted transactions are declined by one or more of these security and anti-fraud services in their tech stack. They don't know what that looks like. And based on the research that has been published by banks and payment providers, et cetera, those declines can range depending on the vertical and depending on the markets in which you operate. Those declines can range from anywhere from 10 to 40%. That's what the data shows. And so the reality is that merchants are potentially missing out on 10 to 40% of revenue because customers simply cannot actually complete a transaction with them. And in many cases, these transactions are actually valid transactions, aren't they?
Then that's the crazy thing. And I agree with everything you said there. It's when I look at it from the merchant point of view and then from the payment provider point of view. From the merchant point of view, e-commerce is tough. You know, we were talking about this the other day. You're in a competitive world and you're trying to get customers to your site. You finally get them there, you get them into the basket, and then your basket drop-off rate's huge, right? And so you're spending time on incentives and pop-ups and real-time chats and concierge and free delivery and rewards, anything. They're you can name 50 companies. They're trying to solve that problem. And you're converting to get to the pay page. You get to the pay page and you are working with leading kind of payment gateways. And they have that you tokenize your card. You do 3DS. You use chargeback guarantees. Can certainly help. Again, tokenization, maybe even orchestration is a bit more heavy lifting there. But you're going through all these pieces and you're using fraud detectors to optimize that. Do they work? The answer is yes. The best players want to orchestrate two or three solutions for their best outcome. But the fact is, all of that happens pre-authorization, right? Everything's trying to, before it happens. You get to authorization, and like you said, 10 to 40%. I think the industry average, including Amazon, is like 12%, okay? And then some people have, you know, very high and some people have a slightly lower. It's a tremendous amount of money. And when we look at this, if you're a merchant, you've gone through all of these kind of obstacles and challenges. And at the last second, that sale is dropped. And in our view, that is your money. And that is your sale. It is money dropped to the floor that should not be lost. And then, you know, I was so attracted to that. This is such a clean solution. It's so pertinent. And a few things that we do is the following. Sometimes some of the chargeback guarantees are good services, but they will approve and not approve things. So you're not sure as your chargebacks are going down, but are you approvals going up? You're not sure, right? There's a little bit of a trade-off. Here it's very clean. The transaction has been declined. Now it is a lost sale. We come in at that point. So that's the first piece. The second piece is we do is we have the AcceptIQ platform. And this is where all the experience from the Experian and the real-time data comes in. We can instantly look at a transaction. We can augment the data. We can restructure the data. We are fingerprinting hundreds of millions of transactions that augments the information even more. We connect it with credit bureau information from some of the models these guys have created. Geolocation. We look at all of this. And what we're doing is we're taking a simple six-variable transaction, because that's what goes through the pipe today, and we're making it a much fatter file. And with that, we can instantly score, say, hey, with this information, we think the propensity to actually make this a successful transaction is very high. That's the first thing we do. We then match it with something also unique. We purchase the invoice. It's a factored transaction. Once we've scored it, based off that, we purchase the transaction. So now on a per transaction basis, I'm looking at the merchant saying, hey, that was a lost sale. I am paying you for that invoice. Deliver the products. I will reauthorize it. So that the guarantee on a per transaction is very attractive. And then the third part is the customer experience. The customer, we are absolutely committed. The customer should get the product they want. They should use the card or payment type that they chose within the existing credit lines and limits that they have at no cost to them ever. We only use on their invoice, they'll come up as the store name, not our name. If it, the authorization doesn't work, it's on us. We don't collect. We don't follow up. So it's got to be seamless. It's got to be a really seamless piece. And that allows us to be embedded. And that was a critical factor. So the combination of all these things. And the last one is we cover all decline codes. We do it real time and subscription. So there's no one in the market. You talked about the kind of uniqueness. There's no one that's doing post-auth real time the way we're doing it. And so we're really excited about it. We're excited about what it means. We've seen 30% reductions in declines. This isn't a lot of the solutions you're talking about. If you look at it, it's a 1% improvement. It's a 2% improvement. We're talking about a 30% reduction in declines. So these are big, chunky numbers. And it goes back again from a merchant's perspective. And I used to pitch to merchants. So I would feel the pain if we had an issue and our approval rates went down. They were upset. They were definitely stressed. Because it's their money and it's their sale. And as you correctly said, Jason, a large part of these transactions, for every fraud that you successfully block, you're blocking 8 on average good transactions. So it's a ton of money being left uncollected.
And let's break this down into some real life scenarios from my own life, right? I have had 3 recent real life scenarios where I was declined a transaction and all of my details are correct. All of my cards are correct. I've got credit cards. I've got debit cards. I've got them from different countries and different banks. Some are business, some are personal, but they're all legit and they're all registered to me or companies that I run. And the reality is when I try to book all of the plane flights on this current trip that I'm on right now in the United States, I had to jump through so many hoops, test different cards, test different addresses, if I'm using a New Zealand card, but I'm buying through a Mexican airline, do I want to use my Mexican address because it'll have a better chance of getting accepted? Or do I use my address in New Zealand, the billing address? I've tried both and still they get declined because of course they detect that you're in Mexico. So then I have to use a VPN. I try a VPN. Then I start going through brokers instead of going through airlines direct. In some cases, I have to go through a broker like a Webjet just to be able to use the payment method that I want to use for that particular flight. If it's a business cost, for example, and I need to charge it back to the business. I literally, what should have taken me, because I knew exactly what flights I needed to book, I knew exactly who I needed to book them through, and I knew exactly which times they needed to be booked for, what should have been a 15-minute job for 3 sets of flights ended up taking me over 2 hours to figure out the combination of cards, addresses, and sellers to be able to buy the flights that I needed to complete my business trip. Now, that's one example. Second example. I use Uber a lot for business. Now, I have several cards saved in there. I wanted to add a new card to Uber, which was my Payoneer International business card. Uber would not accept the Payoneer card. Now, Payoneer is one of the largest issuers of debit cards in the world. They're a massive issuer, and they work across the business and personal space. It refuses to accept the Payoneer card. It would accept a Wise international card. It would accept certain business cards of mine, but not others. The card I wanted to use was my Payoneer card, right? Because I'm in US operating in USD and my balance on that card and that bank account was USD. So I thought USD to USD means there's no exchange rate fees, et cetera, et cetera. Bang, cool, save some money. Wouldn't accept my card. Third and final one I'll tell you about that happened recently. When I'm buying gifts for international family members and friends around the world, I will usually try to shop in their country,
correct,
buying online in their country instead of buying it in my country and then having to internationally pay for international shipping to ship it from my home country to my destination country. I'll hop online. I'll go on to like maybe a local flower shop, or I'll go on to a local retailer store. But oftentimes they will not accept my international credit or debit card. And that's in my name. It's a legitimate card. It's a legitimate transaction. And once again, I usually have to go through 2, 3, 4 tries before I can get the combination of address and card correct and VPN settings correct, yeah, oftentimes, to act as if I'm a local purchaser. Now, this is utterly, and sometimes I got to be honest with you, sometimes I bail out of those transactions and I find a site that's a little bit more lenient that will allow me to actually complete my transaction easily and quickly. This is three examples that have happened all within the last couple of months where these businesses in many cases will just simply miss out on my purchases, full stop. And these are not insignificant purchases either.
Yeah, no, look, the first one is you are a Kiwi, so just the fraud rules against Kiwis are just
through the roof.
But working past that, look, it's what's amazing is you tell that story as a consumer, and it's frustrating. You feel the frustration, and then you're connecting that frustration with the brand of the merchant you're working with. So these declined payments have a bigger, it's not just a lost sale. You're creating, you know, a net promoter score. You're creating an association moment between that consumer and your store. And then the other one is you go back to the, you regularly are setting like these gifts. People are repeat purchasers. So the loss of the sale, if you lose, you're not going to do that purchase. You're not going to do the next 3 or 4 purchases because you've moved on to somewhere else. So the lifetime value here becomes an even bigger multiple. And look, I love the Uber example because the actual flex charge kind of origin story, like a Batman origin story, was actually Zev Chaval, who is one of the founders, Uber. He was exact same. He was on an Uber. He's got great credit. He uses it all the time. And he was declined. He was here in the States and he couldn't believe it. And the frustration level, it was late at night, trying to find another car to upload it. And that was really the point. He's like, why is this happening? And he understood data too. He said, I've got a good track record. I've shown this behavior multiple times. I have a credit limit on my card. Logistically, it doesn't make sense. It wasn't some surprise out of character transaction. And he started to look into it and he started to see all of these issues. And he connected that dot with the experience that he and Elio had with real-time decisioning, and it came together. And look, it's the problem. There are solutions that are going to make it better, okay? And I'm a big believer in the things that Visa, MasterCard are doing around fraud detection, around tokenization, and there's some good business out there. But the problem will only get worse before it gets better. AI is a great, powerful tool, but equally, fraud is going to get a lot more sophisticated, right? If you had voice recognition as a second authentication, that's dead in the water now, pretty much, right? Because you can AI copy it. Fraud is going to go through a really fruitful period here leveraging AI, and you can guarantee that those guys are ahead of the curve on how to leverage those tools. So this is probably going to get worse before it gets better, which means more sales lost. And what will happen is people will pull back even more because they're nervous. So having a company that can very nimbly look at information, augment transactions, and de-risk and actually take on sales is going to be important if you want to grow.
And I think that many merchants don't actually understand, first of all, the scale of the problem. Second of all, the brand damage that occurs, as you rightly alluded to. But third of all, they don't really understand what a differentiator it can be for them if they effectively are put in a position as a brand that can accept pretty much 100% of transactions and that they have the safety net in place to be able to do so, that they can kill 3 or 4 birds with one stone with this solution. They can make their brand more sticky because they're authorizing these transactions. They can make customers happier going through the purchase experience because they're not getting decline after decline. In the airline situation, in one case, I tried 3 different cards. They all failed. And after 3 attempted transactions, the airline blocked my account. And they said there was a warning that came up on screen. You need to call this number to have your account unblocked and we will take payment over the telephone with you. Luckily, the 4th one I tried when I called them was approved and they let the transaction go through. This is the type of absolutely horrific customer and user experience that we just have to address as an industry.
And we've seen as we start to build out the data and fingerprint all these transactions and locations and MCC codes and start to build the learning. We've seen some fascinating things where the same transaction, and you'll send it twice to the merchant just to test, and it'll come back with two different decline codes. It's the same car, same limit, same product, everything. And you have to, all the merchants have their own roles. Each issuer, Chase and Citi and Wells, to all sorts of small banks, they all have their own fraud detection rules. And then the processors have their rules as well. But even within the processors, there are gateways that sit on top. And the data transformation that happens as you pass a transaction from merchant to gateway to processor, processor to bank, it is not as clean as you think, because people are updating rules, are updating decline codes, mappings of data change. And we've seen this. And we know in the industry, if you're running a gateway, then you are up to here with tech demands. So you're always trying to get the next new product in, the next new demand. You're not really going down and, you know, cleaning up and synthesizing all of the detailed plumbing. And I use that kind of that example that this all accumulates to that inefficiency factor of, look, there is fraud. There are things that need to be blocked, but there are so many good transactions that need to be fixed. And you can't just fix it with a network policy. We're able to broker and help solve part of the problem in a really effective way. And like we said, there's a real economic piece, but the lifetime value and the brand piece matters. And frankly, if you're a PSP, a payment service provider, you're competing. Nuvei's had some great articles recently that they posted online about acceptance, how important it is. It's keying in on this topic. And when you're competing in the market in the online space, if your acceptance rate drops below, the merchant will switch to the other person. So the merchant, the best merchants can afford to have two or three gateways, and they're playing themselves off each other. And if you're just using a single gateway, you're not optimizing. So you need to look at the tools to boost up your acceptance rate.
And I think that if businesses could, because when we think about the exploding CAC costs, the customer acquisition costs for most brands online, they're going through the roof, right? And yeah. And if we think, if a brand could be told tomorrow that there was a new marketing technology platform, for example, that they could implement that was relatively low cost, that could instantly improve their conversion rate by 10%+ simply with the flick of a switch, how many marketers do you think would be absolutely falling all over themselves to make this happen? Because I tell you, an increase in conversion by 10% is just, it is so almost unachievable in any other way, in any other form, that a marketer would think you were joking. They would think that the numbers were fabricated. They would need some kind of hard proof to show that the conversion rate could be improved that substantially. And yet here we are. They've done the customer acquisition. They've gotten them onto the site. They've gotten them enticed enough, and they've driven so much desire that people have added products to their cart. They've gone to the checkout. They've put in their details. They put in their delivery address. They put in their billing address. They put in their card details. They put in all those things, and then all of a sudden, boom! It's like, yeah. Wah. Yeah. And it just feels, it's just heartbreaking to think about all the effort the brands go to court new customers, onboard them into the business, and create enough of a value prop that the customer actually wants to spend money with them, only to have declinatures, basically. And in many cases, these are declinatures they know nothing about. They don't even know what's happening. They don't know what percentages it's happening at. And they, more importantly, they don't know where in the stack it's even occurring. That's the worst part. Yeah. So it's like a dog chasing their tail trying to figure this out.
And I think, Jason, you really touch on a really interesting thing as we sit here. So we're a new company. We're growing very rapidly. We're growing kind of an exponential level as we slowly board more and more clients on. And we've started with a lot of kind of CRM platforms and kind of integration platforms, and that gets us to merchants. And now we're starting to really build out our sales team and talk directly to larger merchants. The biggest challenge that we have is, how do you find the right person to talk to? The merchants have so much incoming, right? When you go to NRF, it is terrifying how many people are trying to sell to merchants, because they've got the customers, right? There are millions of products coming at them. And like you said, there's so many points of pass. So it's really getting the message to the merchant, a point of clarity, saying, look, you have a problem here. There's a very doable integration. We integrate at the CRM level, the shopping cart, or the gateway level. as long as we can access the card number and the decline API, we can do business. So there's a lot of flexibility. You don't have to depend on your incumbent gateway even. We can grab it. We can process on the back end through 8 separate processors now, and we're going to keep expanding that. So we're creating all sorts of ease of use, but it's just getting the message to say, hey, what is your decline rate? And as you say, some will know it. A lot don't. They'll go, no, I think it's 97%, 98%. And I've seen 2 examples where one, we say, why don't we help you? We can take it. We can clean it up, dedupe it, and play it back to you. And the 98% was actually 88%. And they were like, they could be like, I'm losing like 12, 13% of my sales. Couldn't believe it. The other example I saw in a call was they're like, no, we confirmed it's a 96% acceptance rate. That's pretty top level. That's an amazing number. But what you realize, the number they're telling was all things that were rejected for fraud, funds not available, do not honor, clearly aren't savable. So they didn't count that.
Oh.
Like, that's assumed that's unsavable. And so they're, you know, adjusted, it's we only lose 3%. I'm like, no, you lose 10. Like that stuff that you assume is just dead in the water is not. It's absolutely salvageable. And so you gotta explain the opportunity. You've got to find mind share with them. And for us, it's just about getting the you know, point by point, merchant by merchant. And we are showing over 30% with our merchants. These are big numbers. And we know what we're doing is not easy to copy with the experience we have, the setup we have. You need the DNA of deep decision science and then payments and payments risk management that we've put together. It's a pretty cool cocktail so far.
Yeah, I guess if you have a team that comes from that QAS background, the reality is, for those that don't know, I have been familiar with QAS for many years because Quality Addressing Services, before they just went by their acronym, they had better addressing data in most instances for customers than the local flag carrier postal services had in their own country. So I noted, for example, this is going back years and years ago, QAS, when you were wanting to basically auto-populate and auto-suggest addresses at checkout for people to auto-populate their addresses or auto-correct addresses when people put them in incorrectly, the QAS API endpoint that you would connect into your checkout was actually a better and more accurate endpoint than NZ Post or Oz Post at that time. And so that's why people loved the QAS service. So it is possible that a private company can actually have better, more clean databases with better decision science behind them than even very large national organizations within specific countries. Hey team, have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
No, I actually love that example about, like I said, the power, like I said, a private company coming in, that data augmentation to create enhanced value. A former colleague of mine from Barclays, I'll give him a free pitch. He's created a company called Factum. It's exactly that. It's a KYC tool. He's augmenting the information, correcting it, name matching better. And he's selling to the likes of the biggest banks in the entire world. These are the top 10 banks in the world who have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this. And you think that they have endless information, yet he can come in and he just focuses on that. He's creating a huge value for them. So that these types of examples are very exciting, very exciting.
And for you guys, from a technical perspective, let's just dig under the bonnet just a little bit here from a tech perspective. So I consider you post processor service, as I understand it anyway. I could be wrong here. So you got a payment processor here. You've got a gateway provider. You've got an integration with some acceptance service where you can put in a card, set of card details. It gets sent off to the processor and effectively it gets accepted or it gets declined. And now usually they have hanging off of the back of that, they have a suite of APIs, some better than others.
Yeah.
Some have rubbish APIs, some have very good APIs. And so they make those APIs available so that you can, first of all, custom integrate their gateway into solutions that they don't have an out-of-the-box integration with, first off. Second of all, they also allow the connection of these APIs in terms of the responses from their gateway so that services like yours can plug into that response from the API and do something with it, take an action off the backside of that.
Correct.
And it's my understanding that you guys are post-processor. You're listening for that response and you're saying, okay, even if it's a decline through the gateway, we're going to take all that information that comes back and we've actually captured the tokenization of that information so that we can then further, we can send it to a series of alternate processors so that we can get this cash in and give it to our merchants. And in fact, we're going to guarantee it. We're going to give it to our merchants, even if we can't collect from the end customer.
Correct. That's 100%. What we're doing is we're intercepting that decline API message, right? So it's coming back through the pipe. And before it shows up to you on the shopping cart as a decline, it's going into us and going through those steps that we talk about, the evaluation, augmentation, restructuring, and scoring, and then the decision to purchase. And that's about 2 seconds of what it takes. And then based off of that, then we plug the response back into the flow and you get an accept instead of a decline. If we don't purchase it, it comes back as a decline. If we do purchase, it comes back as an accept. And then you get the message of the product will be delivered. And below it says our payment partner flex charge will complete the transaction. So that's how that process works. Yeah, it's a post-authorization, post-processor. And so we're a plug-in. And one of the things we tell our partners is, look, use the fraud service, use the chargeback guarantee. Think about, look, you've got to maximize and think about your return. But the good news is you've spent all this money on all these pieces. What's your decline rate? It's there. And then here we can take X percent off of that number. So for me, this is the math around it. And if you're a retailer, the math around it is very clean. You're not trying to guess. I use another similar service where they help with orchestration and they help with some of these strategies about chargebacks. And you're paying like a monthly retainer, right? You're paying, this is when I was at Paysafe. And was it a good service? Yeah, they were smart and they were good. And I'm certain we had some benefits. But after a while, the question is, as a CEO, I'm going, I paid them a lot of money. Yes, that I know. And my acceptance rate, is it better? It feels like it's the same. No, but things have gotten worse here. So relatively speaking, it's better. I'm like, I'm going on faith, or how do I know? So you think it's better, or like your fraud rates have gone down, but your acceptance rate's gone down half a basis point. So I think net I'm better. It's probably there, but it's a little foggy with this math. And I just like the purity of it. It's like, hey man, you're losing 1,000 sales and we saved 300 of them and it's there. You told me you lost these 300 and I saved them for you. So it's, you can point to your return on investment. And I think that's one of the keys. If you're a retailer and you're being bombarded with all these pieces, getting something that gives you that clarity, that kind of, you can touch the tangibility of, I can get a clean return on investment. We don't have some sort of subscription or monthly or annual commitment. Just plug it in. It's going to give the return. If it doesn't, unplug it. It's a very clean offer.
And completely transparent too, in the sense that
100%.
we're only going to take action on what would have been declined anyway, because we're listening to the API and we're listening only for declinatures. So this is revenue you would never get anyway. So the reality is that there's no downside.
That's the beautiful part of it, yeah.
This is an extra safety net there for merchants. And so for you guys, how do you charge? How do you make your money? Is it on a per approved transaction basis or a percentage of the GMV that goes to the platform?
The ticket. It's the percentage of
the sale that you can help save.
Correct. 100%. And we vary that price. It depends on the risk and reward. If it's a riskier merchant, we're going to charge more all the way to, if it's a low risk merchant, we charge a lot less. So it really works with the economics. We don't make it too complicated. We tend to just fix a single price with the merchant. We don't want multiple price, but we look at the merchant. We have the conversation. Say, look, based off of, you know, your history of your everything, we would save it at this certain percentage. So it's a fixed price as a percentage of the ticket. And if you think about it, again, go back to that journey. If it's a service, right, the profitability is 100% margin because, right, there's no fixed cost. If it's a physical good, you've produced the product, you've spent the money on the marketing, you've spent on all of the steps to convert it to get it to a decline, basically. So the margins are extremely high at that level. There are going to be cases, a Taylor Swift concert, she's going to sell those tickets, so she doesn't need us.
We're pretty
good. That use case doesn't work, but the vast majority of cases, this is it's a lost sale and retailers know it. And it's just, again, it's your money and it's your sale that we think is dropped to the floor incorrectly. And that gets us angry. We want to help you and turn that around and get more money, more growth for you.
And how do you think about services like Signify, ClearSale, and there's a number of other chargeback guarantee companies that act as insurance? Do you consider yourselves effectively a replacement for that? Or do you suggest that merchants, especially once they get to a certain scale, still take advantage of those types of platforms that can help protect you on the ones that go through, that maybe slip through the anti-fraud and would normally be charged back anyway? Does that feel like an enhanced safety net that merchants should avail themselves of?
Yeah, no, I think it's an all of the above. There is no silver bullet. Anyone that's selling the silver bullet, just kidding themselves. And I was heading a panel at that big payments conference last year, and we had a senior guy that ran the risk products from PayPal, and we had the head of product from Google Pay as well. So it was a really good panel, and we were debating this and getting questions from the crowd, and it was very consistent. It is an all of the above. You do want to limit, right? You do want a fraud screen. Depending on the business model you have, how important and impactful are chargebacks, and the Signify and the Riskified have good solutions. They have good solutions for this. You may want to orchestrate. There's some decent orchestrate platforms out there. Bit of a heavier lift to integrate. It's been my experience, but they can smart route to trying to get some better improvements. So all of these things, if you're a merchant, you've got to look at all those pieces and then look to your gateway to say, what can you give me and what do I have to augment myself? But we see ourselves as a complement. Again, the post-auth world is empty, right? And so everyone does all of this work. And then we see $500 billion of sales that no one's taking care of. And so we plug and add on. And what we're seeing is the add-on we have is significant. It's not the 1% optimization here, the two. We're talking 25-30% of declines are being improved. And if you lose 15% of your sales to declines, that's a 5% increase in revenue. That's a lot of money. That's not conversion rate. That's revenue. And again, most of the expense has been spent. So the vast majority of that's dropping right to the bottom line. So these are meaningful impacts. And then finally, the last part is that LTV, right? That lifetime value. We are pitching to some big national newspapers, online and physical, like high quality magazines and high quality national journals. And you look at the economics of those guys, these guys are like 8% acquisition rates, right? So they're bringing on 8%.
Sure.
Yeah. In their MacBook, they're losing 6%. So they're on the wheel.
Yeah, right?
They're just spinning all the time. And we just said, look, you take that 8% and you can get that to 9%, because on the first time acquisition, we're helping to boost that up. And then on the tail end, if you have a lost payment, the amount of lost sales you get from that, the people just stop the subscription, is huge. So if you can extend that tail of your subscription, it's got an impact. You add the two together, the numbers explode off the page. The LTVs are like at 40, 50%. It's getting that message and helping them work through that math is our challenge. And we're excited about it.
I don't think merchants realize that some customers like me will bookmark merchants that I have success with every time being able to purchase. And it's never an issue. It's never a hassle. They will tokenize my card and it just goes through first time, every single time without any headache on my part. I don't need to retry anything and it just goes through. I will tell my wife, Sarah, when I go through a perfect friction-free checkout experience, it's so rare and it is so standout. I will tell my wife about it when it happens because it's that rare. And I will tell her that was the best checkout I've ever had. I'm bookmarking these guys. For example, if it's an airline and it's really easy to use, I will be like, that, unless the prices are outrageously more than somebody else, I'm just going to go through these guys because the hassle, my time is too valuable to be shagging around with these companies that make me jump through a million hoops to spend money with them. That's how I feel. I feel like, oh my God, you are making me do somersaults to spend money with you. It feels ridiculous. And I don't think merchants really necessarily fully appreciate how important it is to remove friction at checkout. They just, They don't. They do all the work pre-checkout. Like 95% of their spend is pre-checkout. It's not in the checkout experience.
Yeah, and this is the kind of the payments is those guys. We've hired that payment company to solve it. But it's not. It's your brand. It's your brand. And there are ways to solve it, ways to improve it, ways to demand that it gets better. And that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing. It is a fascinating amount of money. And I have to admit, when I, being a career payments guy, I've been shocked by the inefficiencies because I'm diving so much deeper into it now. And then as we start to meet merchants, seeing some of the issues they have, and you look at that, you're like, man, I wish I'd known that the last 10 years. I would have just put all my effort here. And there is a reason why some of the best ones that you mentioned, the Stripe and the Adyen, they are focused on performance. That is what they're focused on. They know it's not price. It's all about performance. And this is a performance steroid, basically, is what we're offering. So it's where it's got to be.
And if people want to get on board with you guys and try it out for themselves, do they need to be running an existing gateway, for example, that you already support in your suite of supported gateways? Is it that even if they're not running a gateway you support, it's a little bit more of a heavy lift and maybe a little bit more of a custom integration, but we can probably make it happen kind of thing?
Yeah,
how does it work from your side?
It's very flexible because, again, we need to get access to the car so we can work directly with you or your token provider. Okay, so that's the first one. And then two, we need to be able to access the client API, which happens at the gateway level, but it goes all the way to the CRM or shopping cart. So we have a lot of different options of where and how to integrate, and that gives flexibility. So obviously the ideal is, hey, I'm on this gateway, we're already integrated, that's easy. We're just boarding you. There's no integration. We're just boarding you. That's a sweet spot. But the way we integrate gives a lot of flexibility. So if your current payment processor or gateway provider doesn't have it, right, and we're not integrated to everybody, that doesn't matter. We can integrate separately as well. So it gives you that optionality. Again, the three layers of where we can plug our services in is there. And the difference is the boarding is days. An integration is anywhere from a few weeks to a few months if it's very complex. But even those where we want to do the due diligence up front and understand and say very clearly, look, we can access that data and that, the two data points very quickly. This is going to be a 6-week job, and then you can go forward with it.
And in all those cases, even if you don't integrate today, do you charge the merchant to build out that integration, or is that all on you?
It's all on us. We work, we take care of the integration. We're very flexible working with our customers. And look, we're keen to get in the flow, and as are they. So far that hasn't been an issue at all. It's actually been a very happy path for us.
Yeah, and I guess if you integrate with one, you start to learn the pathways, and it becomes a repetitive task that you can get very fast at and very efficient at. So that makes sense. Listen, Philip, this has been a second amazing conversation. I wasn't sure if we'd be able to recreate the magic of that first conversation, but because I truly felt like we had a really great conversation that first time around. I feel like we did. I feel like we pulled it off.
Yeah, that's great.
And this is something that I feel so excited about. I will help shout from the rooftops. If someone is coming into our industry in a transformative way, in a positive transformation way, and is doing something that no one else has decided to take on because it's scary, it's too complex, it's too big, it's too overwhelming, I want to make sure that everybody who's doing right by our industry gets the spotlight that they deserve, because I think that there's not, at times, not always, but at times, there's not enough creative thinking in our industry how to get around some of these big, hard, scary problems. And anybody that chooses to take those on and bear the costs of trying to develop that service out, I believe they deserve all the credit in the world for trying to help make the merchant space better and more productive and more successful, not only for merchants, but the end customers that they serve. And I wish, selfishly, I wish you were integrated with every single merchant that I work with, because I feel this pain on an almost daily basis.
I wish being that too.
being a digital nomad who travels frequently and who has bank accounts in multiple countries, it is a true nightmare. And there's a lot of Kiwis that move over to Australia. There's a lot of Australians that move over to New Zealand. That's just one example. where these poor people, they're trying to use their cards all around the world, but they're saying, now my billing address is here, my physical address is here, my BIN is here, but then I'm buying in this country off of this domain, and none of it seems to match up. And so it automatically gets filtered out by anti-fraud. But these are legit people. These are good people. These are people that are not trying to commit fraud. And I think that the thing that you are trying to do is to try to make sure that good people don't get declined unnecessarily. And I think that's a worthy, goal.
Yeah, no, look, I couldn't have said it any better. That to me was the biggest hook when I had the privilege to start working with Elio and Zev on this, is they came out at a problem from outside the industry without any of the obstructions of this is how it's done. They came in with a fresh mind. They came in with a very clear solve for problem. And it's such a clear, we're solving this problem to make this better. And that is that kind of that statement that we can reduce the clients to drive up your revenue by this much was such a powerful piece. That's why I joined. I was like, that is different. And the way they've approached it with the DNA that they have, that combination, it's exciting. And look, it's live, we're growing. And we just want to get it out there and talk to as many merchants as possible and tell the story right now.
Yeah, and look, I'll just draw on what we discussed last time, because one of my questions was, are you basically building this to be acquired? Are you a banking guy? You're an M&A guy. You know what you're doing. You could probably get maximum value out of this company after another 3, 4, 5 years. But you said, look, we're in it to win it. We have no desire right now. We have no plans to just quickly grow and then sell ourselves off to the highest bidder anytime soon. So that tells me that, look, if it happens, but you're really in this to help make merchants and customers' lives better. And I have massive amounts of respect for that. And listen, Philip, I really appreciate your time today. It's been as enjoyable the second time around as it was the first time around.
Likewise.
And I've really enjoyed this. And we're now at the time where we're coming down to the end of our time together, but I love to flip the script and turn the microphone over to my guests, let them ask me one question, any question they like, personal or professional. So Philip McHugh from FlexCharge, what is your question for me today?
I'm gonna do two pieces. So one, what was the hook that got you so involved and so passionate about the retail world? A little bit about that journey. And then two, what's the greatest rugby team of all time?
Look, I'll answer the second one first. Look, it's got to be the All Blacks. Has to be. I'm not a big rugby fan, but look, I would say 85, 90% of the rugby games I've watched in my life after living in New Zealand for so long were the All Blacks. And I tell you, it becomes an exciting sport to watch. Even if you're not a massive fan, it becomes a very exciting sport to watch when you're seeing two top shelf teams play each other and clash on the field. Unlike American football, where there's pads and helmets and everything up to the gills, these guys, they don't wear pads, they don't wear anything. And you can hear, if you watch them live, you can hear them, even if you're in the nosebleed seats, you can hear when they make contact on the field, and it is bloody scary.
It's brilliant to watch. And it's the only sport where they have something called a blood timeout. So it's
absolutely love that. Now, in terms of retail, look, it's so interesting. I like most of my peers, I think, especially those of us that have a few gray hairs and have been doing this for greater than 15, 20 years, most of us have fallen into this industry. Like I literally fell into this industry. I had a friend who had a mutual friend that was running an agency. He was an American guy in New Zealand. He was looking for somebody to help come and build his agency. I knew e-commerce was going to become this big thing. I didn't know how big, and I didn't necessarily know completely how transformative it would be, but I knew it was going to change everything forever to a degree. And he was looking for somebody to come and help build his agency, do some digital marketing, do some biz dev, etc. And it was this chance introduction and this chance meeting between two people that drew me into the industry. And I instantly, I think because I'm naturally curious and I'm naturally technical in nature, I loved the fact that there was a very technical element. Because at that time, it was all about Google, and it was all about how could you game Google? How could you get links? How could you do link swapping? How could you create SEO keyword-rich pages without getting pinged by Google for black hat efforts? How could you, in the beginning, when AdWords, for example, because it's Google Ads now, but then it was called AdWords, when it was 5 cents a click, it felt like it was the gold rush. And I was running, when I started my own e-commerce pure play with a business partner, we were paying 5 cents a click for Google Ads. It was just it felt like the Wild West all over again. It was fun. Yeah. It was exciting. It felt like there was this tech, but there was this almost mystery to it. It was trying to figure out what Google wanted you to do so that you could be ranked and so that you could make sales. And it was, just, I don't know, I was just fascinated by the whole entire thing. I don't think I ever thought of myself as a retailer, even when I was a retailer. And even when I had a pure play e-commerce website of my own, I never really thought of myself as a retailer. I thought of myself more as a problem solver than anything else. And it was always, how can I try to find stuff to sell where I can arbitrage it, make at least a little bit of money on it, but that is the demand, sorry, the sales and the revenue are going to be born out of a genuine need and demand in the marketplace, not a want, not a desire, where I've got to go out there and try to create this desire artificially. It's how can I try to identify the areas that are not being serviced in the market? Yeah. And there's this just this huge disruptive opportunity where you can play this disruptor role. And that was always the thing I think that made me excited, because I never really liked back then, not so much now, but back then there would be two or three layers of B2B sales that would happen before a product would ever get into the end consumer's hands. So there'd be maybe a manufacturer, maybe there'd be a global distributor, then there'd be a local distributor, then there'd be the retailer, and then there'd be the customer. And I saw this over and over again. I thought, this is flipping, this is ridiculous. Crazy. Like, how did these monopolists get in this these power positions where they basically, they're charging a toll just for these products to traverse their warehouses on the way to the customer? I just thought, this is friggin' criminal. And I thought, why can't we, as our business, why can't we just import it directly from the bloody manufacturer, warehouse it locally ourselves, and ship it directly to the end customer ourselves? One middleman. And we hold all the...
Clear point, yeah.
Yeah. And that, to me, felt, I don't know, you felt like a superhero. You felt like you were not only making money, but you felt like you were doing something good for society in the process. And you weren't lining the pockets of these monopoly rent seekers along the way. And that just always felt, man, the closer I can get to the customer and create a direct route, a direct pipeline from the manufacturing plant to the customer's hands, if I can do that, if I can create that pipeline, I'll always be able to create a business on that. And then I got into the more technical sides of it and helping other businesses to realize that opportunity in their own business. And it's just grown from there. And it's a true passion, and I love it.
Very similar journey. Very similar journey. I love it, Jason. Great stuff.
Philip, I really appreciate the time together. I will put links to the website as well as your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. But other than LinkedIn and through the website, how do you like people to get a hold of you?
First of all, our website's www.flex-charge.com. So go on there. You can always reach out to us. And then maybe if you could put my email and Zev Cheval's email sometime in the podcast so people can see it and we can show that. So it's philip@flex-charge.com and zev.cheval@flex-charge.com. That's how to get in touch with us, and we'll respond and help you to help start solving problems.
Philip, it's been absolutely my pleasure. Once again, second time lucky. Thank you very much. Can't wait to have you on again soon. Appreciate your time. Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.